The next case is 95-1653, New Hampshire Insurance Group versus Jack Frost et al. Mr. Gallagher.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Patrick Gallagher, counsel for Appellant Brightstone. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. This morning I would like to discuss three issues with you. The first issue is whether an employer who commits a blanket ship tort necessarily expects or intends the resulting injury.
Can I ask you start with a procedural question? The employer here is not a party. Is that
correct? Correct?
They did not appeal, which means that I don't understand that. Can you explain to me why the employer wouldn't be interested in the judgment in this case?
Your Honor, the employer is now out of business.
Ah, okay. That's why the insurance company is that's why the important party. Okay.
Correct. Issue number two is whether the New Hampshire General Commercial Liability Policy provides coverage for injuries which are substantially certain to occur. And issue number three is whether it is contrary to public policy to provide insurance coverage for injuries which are substantially certain to occur.
We've gone through this issue in several cases, the Wedge case and some others. At that time, I remember going through the issue of a stopgap policy. And haven't we said that you can have a stopgap policy to, in effect, insure against what is alleged to be an intentional tort?
Correct, Your Honor.
Is there one here?
That was the holding in Harrison. It is true that we do not have a stopgap endorsement here. However, I believe a review of the language of the stopgap endorsement and a review of the New Hampshire policy at issue reveals that the coverage afforded by those policies are identical. The language, both the New Hampshire policy and the commercial liability policy at issue in Harrison define occurrence as an accident resulting in bodily injury which is neither expected nor intended from the standpoint of the insurer. The language of the stopgap endorsement stated that we agree that coverage is afforded for injury sustained by an employee arising out of the course and scope of their employment. So in reality, all the language of the stopgap policy, all that language did was to remove an exclusion for injuries arising to employees out of their scope and course of their employment. But in Wedge Products, this court had already declared that an exclusion for injuries to employees arising out of the course and scope of their employment simply precludes coverage for claims of employees which do not rise to the level of a blankenship tort.
Let's assume for a minute that this court has already ruled on the public policy aspect of this. Your other argument here, as I understand, is policy language, which I think anybody's arguing is in any way unenforceable. It's just whether or not your exclusion covers this scenario and whether you can apply that exclusion. Forgetting public policy for me.
Correct.
So to me, this is a little different, this case, as much as we are looking at the case from before trial. What we have is judgment. We have a declaratory judgment action to determine whether or not that judgment, the payment of that judgment, would be excluded by policy language.
Correct.
Okay. And the policy language, defines occurrences as not including expected or intended injuries. We have a judgment that's based on deliberate intent or actual knowledge of substantial injury. Now, that's what I think we ought to address, is that argument about whether or not, even under Harrison, our cases, does those judgment that we have, the jury decided that there was an actual knowledge. That changed, right? That the statute has changed, but at the time that this judgment was entered, the standard was that there had to be a determination that there was actual knowledge of substantial, that a substantial, or an injury was substantially likely to occur.
Yes, Your Honor, that is.
Why don't you address that?
That is defining the fact that the trial court's decision in Stump versus Industrial Steeplejack. In that case, yes, Greg Frost had actual knowledge that the roping question was deteriorating.
No, we have a jury determination that he had actual knowledge, because we can't debate that anymore.
Correct, and I'm not debating that at all. I'm acknowledging that Mr. Frost had actual knowledge of the deteriorating condition of the rope. However, the question now becomes, with that knowledge, the question becomes, did he subjectively intend or expect the injuries which resulted to Mr. Stump? And I think the answer to that has to be no, because Mr. Frost climbed aboard that very scaffolding with Mr. Stump, fell to the ground with Mr. Stump, and suffered injury with Mr. Stump. This court's holding in Physicians Insurance Company versus Swanson requires that if an insurer is going to avoid coverage, it has to demonstrate that the injury itself was actually expected or intended by the insured. That holding, coupled with the policy language from the standpoint of the insured, requires New Hampshire to prove that Greg Frost subjectively and actually expected those injuries.
But then think, that's what I want to address. The jury determined that there was actual knowledge of substantial injury. Now, we can't go back and have us look at that again.
Sure.
We have to start with that as a given.
I will. My position is that expected is not a defined term under the policy. It does not necessarily equate to, that if he has knowledge of the injury substantially certain to occur, he necessarily expects that injury to occur. And I think this is one case where the employee can conclusively demonstrate that the employer did not subjectively expect the injury. He may have had knowledge, as framed by the Van Clausen court.
Had action.
Yes, Your Honor, I'm acknowledging that he had actual knowledge that injuries were substantially certain to occur. He was sending persons 35 feet in the air, suspended by a deteriorated rope. As framed by the Van Clausen court, that the test is what level of risk exposure is so great as to constitute a flight in ship court. The trial court, this was a trial of the bench in Stump versus Industrial Steeplejack, found that the level of risk to which Mr. Stump was exposed was sufficiently great to constitute a flight in ship court. But I don't think that answers the question at issue here. The question at issue here is, did Mr. Frost subjectively expect the injuries that resulted to Mr. Stump? And the answer has to be no, because he climbed aboard the scaffolding with him.
The jury found otherwise. The jury, in this case, see, you're trying to go back and ask me to look the case again, but the jury here found otherwise.
The judgment that we're dealing with is a reversal of the trial court. The trial court in this case found that New Hampshire should provide coverage for Mr. Stump's injuries.
So the underlying judgment is what you're trying to get to.
Correct.
The judgment that showed that there was an intentional tort.
The blankenship tort based upon knowledge, actual knowledge, that injury was substantially certain to occur.
Right. So we don't look now and say, gee, what did Mr. Frost intend, or did he intend, or whatever, because we have legal standard established here by virtue of the judgment that was made.
I agree that the trial court in Stump versus Industrial Steeplejack found actual knowledge that injury substantially certain to occur. I disagree that necessarily means that he expected the injuries to occur.
That's our legal question. We are
correct.
Really looking at the facts here, which is a legal question about whether that's the same thing.
Correct. Okay. And I believe it is not. If Mr. Frost subjectively expected those injuries, he would not have gotten aboard the scaffolding with Mr. Stump.
Wouldn't that have been argued at the, in the trial, in the underlying case? Wouldn't that have been the argument that,
was
rejected? It seems very logical to me, but somehow we have a finding of fact that goes against it.
That was the argument that was presented repeatedly. And again, the Van Fossen Court framed the issue as what level of risk exposure is so great as to constitute a blankenship tort. The fact that he got up there himself simply proves that he didn't, he knew of the dangerous condition.
He
had actual knowledge.
He took a chance. I mean, that's what it comes out of, isn't it? Like many people, they know what a risk is, but they take a chance, and that.
Mr. Frost subjectively did not expect the rope to break.
But aren't you repeating, you get all down to the nitty gritty of the case, you have a verdict for an intentional tort, and you have a policy that doesn't cover intentional acts. Isn't that the bare bones of the argument? And you're trying to fit into that. You can't get by the fact that you have a verdict for intentional injury. You have that, no matter how much you talk about either you didn't intend it because he got on the scaffold himself, you have a verdict for an intentional tort, and you can't fit that intentional tort into the coverage of the policy that you have. Tell me how you can fit that intentional tort into the commercial policy that you have, and I'll listen to you.
I believe this is no different than the case in Harrison. In Harrison, this court determined that there are two distinct examples of intentional tort. There's the direct intent where the actor desires the results which follow, and there's the intent which is basically inferred because the actor had knowledge that the injuries were substantially certain to occur.
But there was not an underlying determination of fact, was there, in Harrison? I forgot. But it's not underlying cases there is here where a finder of fact made that decision, is there? In Harrison?
I do not recall.
I think we were dealing with the theoreticals there.
But we still have, in the underlying case, we have determined not that the actor intended the results which followed. We have a determination that the actor had knowledge that the injuries were substantially certain to occur. But that, however, does not answer the question, did Mr. Frost expect those injuries? And still, I go back to the fact that Mr. Frost climbed aboard that very scaffolding. Because he climbed aboard the scaffolding, he must not have expected the rope to break, must not have expected to fall to the ground, must not have expected to suffer injury along with Mr. Stump, and therefore did not expect the injury to Mr. Stump.
And thus, you do not have an intentional tort.
Your Honor, again, as framed by the Van Fossen Court, the test is what level of risk exposure is so great. He exposed himself to the same risk. The underlying judgment was affirmed by the Court of Appeals. That case was reviewed and affirmed.
Sure, the verdict stands that there was actual knowledge of the substantial injury or deliberate intent. But we'll assume that you could have been the jury found on either standard, deliberate intent or actual knowledge.
That's correct, Your Honor, but in this case, it was the charge.
This case is only a declaratory judgment about whether or not the policy applies, the exclusion of the policy applies. But you want to argue the public policy part of this, and I want to argue the policy language. You know, public policy. In Harrison, we may have well said that we're only going to exclude certain intentional, certain ones. Public policy maybe isn't a good reason to exclude where you have just an inferred intent kind of thing. That's what we said. But here, what we have is before the language changed, or after the language changed, so we have a determination about the actual intent. So now does the policy apply? And so I think with what you're fighting uphill, you maybe need to realize that we've heard what you say, that the same fella got up, you know, the employer and the employee went up on the scaffolding, and we're with you. You know, that doesn't seem like it's very intentional, but nevertheless, there's a verdict.
Your Honor, the verdict that you referred to is a verdict that says Greg Frost had actual knowledge
he being the employer,
correct,
he being the insured under this policy.
Correct. But the policy does not exclude injuries which are known to be substantially certain.
It isn't, that's the key, and that's the,
right,
the focus that you're trying to make a distinction between a purpose to cause harm, deliberate intent. It's totally different. That's totally different, and that's excluded under the policy. But is, the question is acts which are substantially certain to occur, are those
necessarily excluded?
Yes.
Or excluded by the policy?
That's right.
So
that's,
my answer is no.
That's right. And you look to physicians, the physician's case.
Correct. Physicians, the holding physician, as well as the policy language that requires that you look from the standpoint of the insurer. And the insurer here is Greg Cross. The New Hampshire cannot sit here and tell us that Mr. My time is expired. I'd like to answer
yes.
this question.
Yes, very quickly.
New Hampshire cannot tell us that Mr. Cross intended or expected those injuries because he filed before his family with Mr. Sauer.
Thank you, Mr. Gallagher. Mr. Machinga.
May it please the court, I'm Walter Machinga. I represent Plaintiff Appellee, New Hampshire Insurance Group.
Counselor, how does this case differ from the Harrison case?
There's no stop dead endorsement in the insurance.
So that's really the major distinction because there was what we called in Harrison a supplement. Is that correct?
I think so. And I think if you look at, I think some of these are identified in the brief. Wedge products came out in 87. This policy was issued about 4 or 5 months after Wedge products. Whether or not the employer considered those or bought to purchase the top gap endorsement, we don't know.
What language in Harrison brought it within policy coverage in what I think we referred to as a supplement?
The stop gap endorsements vary. Now, the Harrison endorsement, I think, simply says we will cover you for injuries to your employees that are as a result of intentional conduct. And the court is supposed to do that. That's against public policy, that type of insurance.
And you distinguished Wedge in that case?
I don't think it distinguished Wedge. I think it didn't.
Well, we said in Wedge that you can't insure against intentional torts.
I think Wedge was purely a reading of the policy language and an interpretation of the policy. I don't think the public policy aspect of whether or not you could insure was addressed in Wedge. I think it only came out in Harrison.
Is that right?
That's my read.
I think we specifically said that you can't insure against it, but I would defer to you. I'll look.
Counsel,
the language, I mean, it's a pretty fine eye in the needle that the injured party here is trying to thread. Might the language be a little more helpful in your policy exclusion if it specifically said we're going to cover injuries may occur in your premises, but we specifically do not, with this policy, cover injuries that are the result of so-called intentional torts, and make the precise reference, because the precise language that your policy exclusion uses, neither expected or intended, is slightly different than the test put to the jury to determine whether or not there is an intentional tort.
Your Honor, the policy, again, was written, was issued and sold, purchased by the employers within months of the Wedge products ruling. Wedge basically came out, and I think clearly enunciated that under a comprehensive general policy, which is identical in the language to this policy, this is not a policy that will cover an intentional tort. Now, should the insurance carrier then go on then to make specific exclusions when the court in the Supreme Court of Ohio has said this is not something that's covered under these policies, I think it's reasonable to say that wouldn't be a necessary step. But when you just simply go back to what this policy is about, it says Jones test, which said that he believed it was a necessary harm, just deemed an expected act. And where the standard is raised to actual knowledge.
Might you agree, though, if this were subject to a jury question as well, and you threw that language out, expected or intended to, from the standpoint of the insured, and you tell the jury the insured's right up there on the scaffold with this guy, pretty good chance the jury's going to say, well, couldn't have expected or intended within the plain meaning of those words, or he wouldn't have been up there on the scaffold.
We're dealing with a specific set of facts that have occurred in this litigation. Nothing precluded employer from bringing that action before this case went to trial. So listen to that testimony to attempt to establish factually that he had some purpose other than substantial certainty of harm being on that scaffold. That isn't the case here. And what may have occurred and what might have happened are conjectural.
Could the jury finding also be that the employer just took a great risk himself?
Sure, I mean, we
didn't have any laboratories that I could see tested and sure was predicted, so could the jury have found that there was a substantial risk and the employer took the risk himself? He was in a hurry, he was busy, he had a job to do, and he took the risk.
I think there was evidence before the court on that issue, and that he, upon being confronted by the plaintiff, the rope was rotted, and he said, you're straight, you go get another rope. You know, we got a job to do.
Compensation, and that's exclusive. Obviously, the finding of intentional tort takes it out of the exclusivity of the workers' comp. The employer is left naked. That's why
he was essentially under the fund.
Because it was in the nature of punitive damages, and we don't let under public policy insurance against punitive damages.
My
husband
Harrison still wasn't performing, and then the payment's not yet, the person was there.
You could see, though, the dilemma we were in at that point.
Yes.
Okay. Well, wait, while we're pushing this out to the what ifs, does your company offer the stopgap?
Does it?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean,
that's the problem with this language, is that you might not recognize that you're not covered.
Well, we know Myron's fund did before thereabouts in the Harrison case, but I mean, that nothing precludes the employer from shopping through his agent for that.
instance, if you don't have insurance, is that you're more careful about your how you treat your employees. I think that's the underlying. Yeah, the employer can certainly have a fund or can certainly have a contingency fund or whatever. It's not as if we need to make sure every employer has insurance, I don't think. That's the theory, I think, under which we say we're not going to, it's against public policy to insure against these sorts of things.
Your Honors, I think that which is still the law controls the interpretation of this policy. Nothing has changed to stand by the length of this policy. The underlying facts in this case establish deliberate intent, establish actual knowledge on the part of the employer. I think this court recently in July in the Deering case versus Nationwide and discussing how insurance coverages are to be applied or not to be applied in the sexual molestation case, found that as the intent raised on sexual molestation is properly inferred as a matter of law and therefore is not part of the potential coverage, insurance coverage that the accused may have had. And I think, too, in taking that same logic into the intentional tort arena, under a finding of under fight where there's substantial certainty of harm, and where the employee is directed to continue to do the work knowing that harm is likely to occur, then and only then can the inference of intent be drawn and considered. And so, therefore, that reasoning in fight and that finding in fight that intent is inferred as a matter of law is not dissimilar from how this court viewed the insurance coverage hearing, to find that there was an intent inferred as a matter of law. And lastly, I would like to say that in this arena of potential towards claimant cases, an element of the tort is intended certainty of harm. And while I think our position is compatible with the people of the Swanson case, the element that is different here is that the people of the Swanson, and when people say, well, the intentional act is still to be covered, to prove the intentional act, you have to prove the harm. That's an element of the tort in the language of potential tort arena. Unless the harm is proven, and then the actor is required, the plaintiff is required to continue to work or conduct himself at that risk, then they've established their case. That's not necessarily so in the BB gun case where you simply are discharging the firearm not knowing if it's going to strike anyone. Here, where the plaintiff come in, when they prove their case, they've established the harm. This is a part of the tort. Combine the logic of PICO and Swanson to find coverage with that element of the tort in existence. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Machinga. Mr. Gallagher, you've used your time. Take 30 seconds.
Your Honor, I would just like to respond that this court in Jones versus VIP Development in 1984 defined the language in tort to be that an act committed with deliberate intent to cause harm or an act committed with actual knowledge that injury was substantially certain to occur. This injury occurred in 1988. New Hampshire had 4 years to modify its policy to provide for an exclusion for injuries which are intended, expected, or which are known to be substantially certain to occur. This employer, in this case, purchased his workers' comp, paid his workers' comp premiums, and purchased the general commercial liability policy. He thought he was covered for everything. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.